Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow, of course, Politics Wednesday. Joining us are political scientists Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University and Evan Renfro of the University of Northern Iowa. Evan's interesting, especially this week, as we'll be talking about Iran. Evan is a former Air Force intelligence officer, so he'll have some interesting observations. Also, in our political news, I see today in response to the flurry of anti-abortion legislation, more than 50 organizations are holding more than 400 demonstrations across the country today as part of the National Day of Action to stop the bans. Last week, if you remember, the state of Alabama signed into law the most aggressively anti-abortion law in recent American history. Now, if enacted, this law would only permit abortions if the mother's life is at risk or if the fetus cannot survive, not in cases of rape or incest. Alabama is one of a growing number of states that have moved to drastically restrict access to abortion over the past few months. Several states, Missouri, Ohio, Georgia, have pursued so-called heartbeat bills, legislation that would ban abortion as soon as a physician is able to detect a fetal heartbeat. And if you remember back in January here in Iowa, Polk County judge struck down Iowa's fetal heartbeat abortion law, ruling it unconstitutional. Joining us with her expertise to talk about more restrictive access to abortion across the country and here in Iowa, Renee Kramer is professor in the Department of Law, Politics, and Society at Drake University in Des Moines. She's in our Des Moines studio. Renee, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
I want to mention, too, that you teach a class on reproductive law and politics, so this is really your wheelhouse. Now, I understand, is this correct? None of these new laws that we've seen passed in various states have yet gone into effect. Abortion is still legal in every state. Can you give us a sense of where you think we are right now, a sort of a big picture view?
Yeah, sure. I think that's a really important thing to start with. No ban that has been passed has taken effect. Even the Alabama ban, which of course is still being challenged, has a 6-month period before it will go into effect. And the first step that any law faces, a ban like this faces, is there's an immediate attempt to get an injunction to make sure that the law doesn't take effect. That decision is made, and that gives time for the constitutional arguments to be made on both sides about whether or not the law passes constitutional muster. So no law has taken effect. All of the laws have been stayed or had an injunction from the beginning, and during the time after that, there are legal arguments on both sides.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about it. I meant in my introduction, I mentioned heartbeat quite a number of times.
Yep.
Iowa has that as the name of its bill. Give us an idea of why all the states have gone to this heartbeat measurement and how that has developed also here in Iowa.
Well, I think it's a really powerful rhetorical name for a bill, a heartbeat bill. It's not necessarily factually correct. So what these bills tend to be are a ban on the procedure after 6 weeks following conception, which is not necessarily a ban on the procedure 6 weeks after your last period. Many women won't know they're pregnant 6 weeks after conception, and they might still indeed be menstruating. So it's a ban on the abortion of a 6-week-old zygote as it's developing into a fetus, which may or may not have a heartbeat associated with it that is detectable. So I think there's a rhetorical interest in calling it a heartbeat. I prefer to call it a 6-week ban because that's what it functions as, is a ban on the procedure 6 weeks after conception.
Mm-hmm. But that is a point when a heartbeat is detected, a point of, I mean, let's go back to Roe v. Wade. I mean, their viability was something that was in the language, right? And
yep.
Something we measured. So does this move the goalpost, so to speak, move the yardstick?
Well, I think it's really important to remember what Roe v. Wade said. Roe v. Wade said that in the first trimester, a mother's interest or a woman's interest or a pregnant person's interest in obtaining an abortion outweighs a state interest in fetal development. That in the third trimester, towards the end of pregnancy, the state might have an overwhelming interest in both fetal development and maternal health. And that in that middle area, that second trimester, the state has to have a good argument for why it's going to impose restrictions. The later ruling in Casey said that the state can't impose an undue burden on a woman's access to a fundamental right of abortion as articulated in Roe. And then the question has been, well, what is that undue burden? Is that undue burden that they need to know they're pregnant? Well, in some cases now, law has said, yes, you would actually need to know that you're pregnant before you can be stripped of the right to terminate that pregnancy. That constitutes an undue burden. Is an undue burden a need for a juvenile to have parental or judicial approval? Is an undue burden the need for a woman to inform her partner or the person who impregnated her that she's planning an abortion? All of these things have come from Roe, which says in that first trimester, women have authority to make a medical decision with a doctor about whether or not to terminate a pregnancy. They are using viability as a goalpost, and then certainly a six-week ban is moving that goalpost. But there are a lot of questions about whether Roe was even an accurate anymore understanding of what viability is and what that means for a woman's decision-making regarding her pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. When you mentioned Casey, we talk a lot about Roe, almost exclusively about Roe, but that case is really important here, and that wording of undue burden, right?
Yeah, and what's amazing is that in Iowa, we didn't need to reach to Roe or Casey. The Iowa law, the six-week ban in Iowa, was struck down in 2019 in Iowa court based on the Iowa Constitution. So there are 9 states in America that have a constitutional right in their state document for women to obtain abortion. And then there are 9 states that have a statutory enabling mechanism for women to obtain abortion. The states where we're seeing the bans now, those states have neither of those, and those will be federal challenges. That's what makes Roe and Casey important. So the challenge in Iowa was all based on Iowa law and what Iowans have expressed as a value in their constitution. The challenges in Kentucky, Ohio, Georgia, Missouri, Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, those are going to be federal challenges where the federal constitution is where the protection lies.
Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit more about the Iowa Constitution. What is the wording in the Iowa Constitution?
I should have known you were going to ask me that. I can tell you in a second. But the main wording, and what's really kind of striking, I reread the decision this morning, is that it actually locates a fundamental right for women's equality in something similar to our constitutional 14th Amendment, the Equal Rights Amendment, not the Equal Rights Amendment, but the Civil Rights Amendment, Amendment number 14, that says we have a right to equal protection under law. Iowa has that, and it specifies out gender, which the 14th Amendment does not. We have to read gender into the 14th Amendment. So this was about a woman's fundamental right to bodily autonomy in Iowa.
But that's not the basis of the Roe v. Wade was decided.
Absolutely. Absolutely not. Roe v. Wade was a penumbral right to privacy that the court said, you know, in order to be a citizen, we have to have rights to privacy. And one of those rights to privacy is a right to autonomy in medical decision making, a right to intimacy. And so some of the cases around privacy, of course, involve same-sex intimacy and the state's inability after a certain point in our constitutional history to ban sodomy or to ban expressions of love between two same-sex partners. That's a similar foundation. We have a right to a private relationship with our bodies. And that's what Roe was found in. Privacy doesn't appear in the Constitution. And it's one of the things that makes Roe susceptible to challenge. Because you can't point to where it is in the Constitution. You can point to where the court constructed it in Roe, in Hardwick, in a bunch of other cases, both in the criminal law and also in interpersonal law.
Renee Kramer is professor in the Department of Law, Politics, and Society at Drake University. And we have her for a few more minutes putting Iowa's abortion bill, the so-called heartbeat bill, legislation that was ruled unconstitutional by a court, Polk County judge, back in January, if you remember. So we have the slew of more restrictive anti-abortion bills across the country. Renee, why now? Is that because of the newly sort of more conservative makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court?
You know, I think that's probably indeed why. the electorates in these states don't tend to favor these bans. So they're not necessarily reflecting what folks would do if they were enabled just to vote, you know, straight out on what a ban would look like. So there has to be something else going on. And I think a lot of what's going on is some very brilliant strategizing by conservative legal actors to try to get a challenge before the Supreme Court with their belief that Roe will fall.
Mm-hmm. Will fall all. Sorry, you were going to go on.
No, go ahead.
No, to fall all at once, or we hear this kind of by death by a thousand cuts, so to speak.
Yeah, I hear a lot of people arguing that this might be an attempt at some incrementalism, which is generally how the law works. I honestly believe that the folks pushing these bans at this point are hoping that they can get Roe to fall. That incrementalism no more.
Completely.
And I think the argument there would be that since 1973. The folks who are pushing this agenda have been very successful in incrementally restricting access to abortion, and that there is a chance now, a real chance, I think they believe, that they could finally put the nail in the coffin of Roe. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 6 months ago, I would have told you that I think they're right. 6 months ago, I think I would have predicted that Roe would be overturned in the next 3 to 5 years. I'm not as sure now, simply because I've been watching John Roberts a little more closely, and I believe the Chief Justice might be the swing vote on this, and that he might, if the court takes a case on abortion, he might, in the interest of institutional legitimacy and lack of judicial overreach and a desire to maintain precedent, he might be the swing vote that upholds the doctrine that we see in Roe.
Yeah, so you're saying because it would look like a swing just because the court's makeup has changed, and it would be a swing so drastically, so quickly after that court makeup change that it would just be clearly politics.
clearly politics and clearly ideological. And the Chief Justice cares very, very much about the court as an institution.
Mm-hmm.
And he believes very strongly that he is making decisions that are jurisprudential and not ideological. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But I think he would feel a lot of compulsion to render a decision in a case like one that could challenge Roe that could be seen as legitimate institutionally.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not sure, and I think there are very strong indications that four people on that court very much want to overturn Roe. And it might be that Roberts swings that way. It would depend, I think, on the facts of the case. And I don't believe that many of the bans that we're seeing actually, it would be hard for me to make a jurisprudential argument to uphold those bans given Roe.
Mm-hmm. Renee, we have a couple minutes left. I wanted to go back to what you said about Iowa's Constitution and the Equal Protection Clause in the Iowa Constitution, and that Roe v. Wade was not decided on equal protection for women, but on privacy grounds.
Mm-hmm.
If this should come to the U.S. Supreme Court, would you expect equal protection to be part of that case or the main pillar of that case?
You know, I think there was a lot of dissent among pro-choice activists and jurists at the time of Roe and certainly beyond about the way that legal claims could have been framed. And I have heard some very persuasive equal protection claims, and I've heard some very persuasive 13th Amendment claims, the compulsion of a woman to use her body in a particular way for the service of another body. I think we would see novel legal claims at the court. I don't know that those novel legal claims would carry the day, and indeed they might be risky. If Roe falls, I think the only federal route to safe legal access to abortion would be an equal rights amendment at the federal level, mm-hmm. a constitutional amendment that explicitly made this part of understanding women's equity and access to things like health care.
I mentioned at the outset in the news some 400 rallies across the country, also in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm reading about, hundreds of activists there today. Does that have any real effect? I mean, they will say it doesn't. Of course, they're deciding the case on the law. On the Supreme Court, are the members of the Supreme Court watching that?
You know, what's amazing to me, and I love to teach this part to students, the Supreme Court, when it hears a case, gets briefs filed. They're called amici curiae briefs, or friends of the court. And they're written by groups who aren't parties to the suit, but who have a material or ideological interest in the suit. And there's really clear evidence in political science that the more briefs the court gets, the more likely it is to hear a case, because that high level of brief engagement signals that this is a controversial issue that needs solving.
Right.
And there is no evidence, mm-hmm. however, let's say they get 40 pro life briefs.
Quickly.
And 10 pro-choice briefs. There's no evidence that they decide in a way that favors that stronger number of briefs.
All right. Very good. We'll have to have you back. Renee
Kramer. Yeah, please do. Thank you.
Professor in the Department of Law, Politics, and Society at Drake University. Thanks so much for coming into our Des Moines studio. We appreciate it.
Have a good day.
You too. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.